Experience is the best teacher. That's probably a statement that you've heard many times throughout your life, as I have. Many people have attributed it to Benjamin Franklin. But in fact, what Mr. Franklin said was exactly the opposite. What he said was, experience keeps a dear school, and a fool will learn in no other. In other words, we really ought to be able to learn some other way than just experience. Franklin certainly didn't deny that experience can give us some very valuable lessons. But he also recognizes that there are a lot less painful ways to learn. And if you have to learn from experience, it would sure be a lot better if you could learn from somebody else's instead of having to make all the mistakes personally yourself. So Franklin gave that particular advice. However, in thinking about that, I also had to recognize, you know, that can become almost rather cynical for us in a sense, because as a matter of fact, experience can teach us some very, very positive lessons as well. There are many things that in life we only learn by experience in good ways. You don't really learn the value of a family by reading a book or listening to a lecture or even a wonderfully delivered sermon. That doesn't really tell you what the value of a family is. Living in a family is what gives you the appreciation for what a family can do. What kind of foods we enjoy? Well, we learn that through the process of trying different ones. We learn what types of music we may enjoy listening to by listening to a variety of different genres. We may learn what sports we enjoy by participating in them. It always seems kind of sad when someone limits themselves in life by only exploring a few choices in any particular area, and they fail to recognize the wonderful variety that's out there available. In fact, I think even in our current situation where we've had so much racial turmoil in our country, I think we would recognize that a person who confines himself to relationships only with those in his own racial or ethnic or similar background to what they already have is really limiting himself in the richness of what different cultures can provide for us and the experiences that we can have. Whether we're talking about music or art or sports, experience will teach us that there are certain things we enjoy and certain things that we don't enjoy. And that's all right. There is what we call an acquired taste, something that perhaps we don't particularly enjoy initially, but over a period of time, we may come to realize that, well, that's really actually a lot better than we thought. It may not be the best example, but the one that I think of that comes to my mind is the first time as a small child, I tasted beer. My grandfather never abused alcohol, but he did enjoy a good cold beer at the end of a day, and I remember as a very small child walking past as Grandpa had that glass of cold beer, and it was this golden color with this white foam on the top and these bubbles, and I just knew it had to be wonderful. And he gave me a taste of it. And I thought, why would anyone in their right mind put something like that in their mouth? Sadly, it has become an acquired taste. But I am told that there are other things that fit in that category as well. Scotch, for example, which I have not fully acquired, but I'm working on it. But there are things that as we go along through experience, we do learn to appreciate in perhaps a different way. Of course, whether we're trying to learn from experiences or not, life just keeps giving us experiences anyway, whether we're ready for them or not. We really can't opt out as long as we live. But what we do with those experiences is largely up to us. Just as the person who limits himself to one type of music or art or food or culture is limiting his ability to enrich his life, the person who simply lives life without thinking about the lessons that he could be learning is really wasting the most precious commodity any of us have. Even though we may not often think about it, we've been given a different perspective. When we add the lessons that life can teach to us, along with the knowledge that God gives us that life does have a purpose and a reason, that he has a purpose for our existence, a purpose for the experiences that he allows us to have, then a Christian begins to recognize that he or she has both an opportunity and a responsibility to learn from life. Many of us would consider it a serious failure to go through life's experiences and not reflect on the lessons we could be learning. Even though we lack the knowledge of God's way, the ancient Greek philosopher Socrates is credited with saying, "The unexamined life is not worth living." In the books of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes together, there are 15 different passages that encourage us to consider various potential lessons from the world around us. We're told to consider God's works, to consider the work habits of the ant, to consider the cause of the poor, so that we may be able to reach out and help them. Solomon writes about learning lessons from passing by the vineyard of the slothful person, from considering the temporary nature of life, from stopping to meditate upon the genuine but very temporary pleasures that life can bring, laughter, partying, relationships, even the effort to build something that will last after you're gone. In the New Testament, Jesus himself continues the theme by urging us to consider the lilies, the ravens, the labor of the farmer in the field. We're told before we're making the commitment of baptism to stop and consider whether we're really ready to do all that it takes to fulfill that commitment. I think one of the blessings of the Sabbath each week is it gives us the opportunity to set aside our mundane daily cares and activities and to think about the trajectory of our lives. What have we done well this week? Where did we come short? What did we stumble into because we just failed to think ahead of time? What can we learn so we can do better next week? The principle, and it leads to the title of my sermon today, is summarized in a relatively short proverb, Proverbs 25 and verse 4. Proverbs 25 and verse 4. It says, "Take away the dross from silver, and it will go to the silversmith for jewelry." Tells us there's a problem with silver in the sense that if it's not refined properly, you can't really use it for much. So you take away the dross. That's kind of the title of my sermon today, taking away the dross. Take away the dross from silver, and it will go to the silversmith for jewelry. In looking at that, I thought, I wonder if there are other newer translations that might capture that in a slightly different way. And I found the contemporary English version says this: "Silver must be purified before it can be used to make something of value." Now, I rather like that. It has to be purified before it can be used to make something of value. Your life and mine is supposed to be made into something of value. But while I like that translation and the point that it makes, it also has a significant weakness to it. Let me read this to you again. "Take away the dross from silver, and it will go to the silversmith for jewelry." New King James. "Silver must be purified before it can be used to make something of value." Contemporary English version. The difference between those two is that the second one is passive. It basically describes the silver as inertly sitting there and allowing the purification process to go by, which is kind of the way a lot of people live their lives. New King James Version says, "You, take away the dross. You have a responsibility with this." So the removal of the impurities is not just something that happens to us while life surges by. I have a responsibility. It's something we must be actively involved in doing. And that's where learning life's lessons comes in. By examining our lives, we learn to identify the dross so that we can go to work on it. So when you examine the quality of your life to see where the dross is so you can take it away and be ready for God to make something of value out of you, what do you find? What have you seen? And what are you doing about it? Now, I want you to notice that I didn't ask, what are you going to do about it? Or what do you plan to do about it? And the reason I didn't ask it that way is because I've planned to do a whole lot of things that I've never done. So the important question is, what are we doing about it? How do we take away the dross? I think for many people, this current pandemic that we've been going through is nothing more than a terrible inconvenience. They can't go out to eat or go to a bar. They can't watch their favorite sport or go to a movie. They have to wear a mask. Everything to them is such a burden. In their minds, this experience, frankly, offers neither personal lessons to be learned nor changes to be made. Yet on the other hand, it seems for some people, they see it as the first of many plagues that are going to lead to the rapture or Armageddon or some other poorly understood religious concept. Some see it as a wake-up call, while others see it as a temporary obstacle to be put behind them until we can get back to the perversely strange and ungodly lifestyle that we've learned to call normal. Now, regardless of your view about the specifics, and I'm going to step very carefully through that minefield by not sharing my personal views, nothing personal, I just think it's a minefield, so I'm going to dance around that. But I would hope that we all realize that what was considered to be normal 6 months ago ceased to exist. That normal's not coming back. So how will your life be different going forward? Now, I'm not talking about wearing masks or washing your hands or social distancing. I mean, what spiritual lessons has this crisis enabled you to learn that you didn't fully realize before? What's the spiritual dross in your life that's being brought to your attention in order to be refined away by this experience? I think there may be many lessons that we could all share. Some of them are common lessons that we all may have. Others are maybe unique lessons to us. And without getting too detailed, what I want to do today is share a few of the lessons that I've been learning over the last few months. My goal is not true confessions, nor am I saying that you should have learned the same lessons I've learned. I'm simply hoping that by sharing some generic form of these lessons, that maybe it can help us to consider the lessons that God is bringing to each of us. I am also acutely aware that I haven't gotten this all figured out just yet. There are more lessons to learn, along with a clearer understanding of the ones I've only started to learn. As one author put it, you can learn a lot from your mistakes when you aren't busy denying them. So I'm calling this portion of the sermon, Lessons I've Learned So Far, I hope, because there's a lot to learn. I originally wrote down 6, but that would have been way too long, so I pared it down to 3. Lesson number 1 that I've learned is, and it fits very well with a bit of what Mr. Hammer was saying in the announcements, not being anxious. It can be more difficult than it sounds. Not being anxious can be more difficult than it sounds. Most of us have lived the majority of our lives in relative safety. In fact, one of the things I've learned from this process is that I really enjoy being comfortable. I don't like those things that make me uncomfortable. But being comfortable all the time really isn't consistent with God's plan for us. So pushing ourselves to grow, to be Christians, just isn't consistent with staying comfortable. This world has encouraged me to strive to be comfortable, and I have embraced that idea with both arms, and that's got to change. Now, a few, maybe some of you, I don't know, may have been military veterans and experienced combat. But for most of us, that's not something that we've ever really been through. The rest of us have very rarely faced in our lives a period of sustained stress. Stress so much that we are concerned for our lives. Oh, I know Texas has tornadoes, but we all know that tornadoes come and go, and you don't sit around and worry all that much. If you've been in South Texas, where the hurricanes come in, as we have one today, down between Corpus and Harlingen, affecting our brethren down there, thankfully a rather lower-powered one, but still a lot of rain and so on. But if you've lived in a coastal area, you know sometimes you can get pretty stressed about hurricanes that seem to be aiming at you as well. But they come and go. You move on. Brief periods of anxiety can be difficult enough for us to deal with. They're really not the same as those situations where the danger just is continually just around the corner. Those who've experienced combat, I think, have a better sense of that and the long-lasting impact that it can have on the way that you think and you live your life. Many of you knew Lynn Torrance and the effects that he went through, his experiences, and it certainly had a profound effect upon him. Living constantly on edge has that kind of an effect on a person's mind. It can manifest itself in many ways from what is today called post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, to depression, to a whole host of other emotional problems. I recently was reading a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, actually the first in a trilogy by Rick Atkinson, and this one was called An Army at Dawn. It's the story of the involvement of the American military at the beginning of World War II in North Africa. It's not a pleasant book to read. Well written, but not a pleasant book to read. Among the figures he gave was the many thousands of men who returned home with varying levels of mental and emotional problems as a result of the experience of living with that constant stress. At the time, it may have been called shell shock or battle fatigue or combat stress reaction, but whatever it was called, it's estimated that 25 to 30% of all the men and women who served in World War II came home with varying degrees of mental and emotional difficulties because of it. It wasn't because they were weak, but God didn't design us to live with that kind of unrelenting stress, and it takes a toll. My father was hospitalized 3 times because of PTSD after he returned from being a prisoner of war in World War II. I only saw it happen once when I was about 10 years old. And thankfully, Dad was not a violent person, but seeing my father lose touch with reality to the point where he had to be institutionalized for a while, something I've never forgotten. On the positive side, I will say that when he came into the Church of God half a dozen years later and received the Spirit of God, that problem pretty well went away. It was a great blessing from God. Now, why do I talk about that? Among the many things this pandemic has done is to place everyone in a position of unrelenting stress. It's there. Some try to escape by denying the seriousness. Some just withdraw, refuse to listen to anything that doesn't fit the way they want things to be. Some obsess with trying to get back to normal. Some try to deny the anxiety. But all of those methods only work for a short while. Some experts have sadly reported that even though we are in many ways in worse shape now than when we had the initial lockdowns, people have quit caring and they've just given up trying. One of the effects I've noted is I don't believe I've ever encountered a time in my life when I've been more acutely aware of my own mortality and the fragility of life. On the one hand, that may sound kind of morose, but David actually says there is a value to that realization. In Psalm 39, in verse 4, Psalm 39, in verse 4, David says, "Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am." Now, I don't think David is saying, "Let me know the day I'm going to die," But he says, help me to have this recognition that this life is temporary. Verse 5, he says, indeed, you've made my days as handbreadths, and my age is nothing before you. Certainly every man at his best state is but vapor. And it uses the interesting word selah, which basically means, take a moment to think about that. Think about it. The word that's used there for vapor is an interesting word. It's the word that describes that little bit of steam coming out of the spout of a tea kettle. You know how long you can watch that. It's gone. And that's the way he describes it. A little further in Psalm 90 and verse 12, he says, and this one actually we believe was written by Moses, but the same concept, verse 12 of Psalm 90, so teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Recognizing the limitations that we as human beings have is a way of enabling us to have a kind of wisdom we couldn't have otherwise. It's interesting what was covered in the sermonette. I'm fascinated sometimes when someone takes the time to talk about at least a little bit of a geographic area where something took place, and it's something that I've seen. I've had the privilege of going to Israel 5 times, so I've seen the Valley of Elah. Actually went into it the first time we were there. Walked along the Brook Sorek where David picked up the stones. Our guide told us, he said, if you'd like to pick up a stone and take it with you home as a souvenir, it's fine because we bring truckloads out every day and dump them for the tourists. But having seen the actual spot, and the last couple of times we've been there, we went to a place we'd never gone to before. The remains of the city of Lachish. We usually call it Lachish, but Lachish is correct. And it fits very well with what we're talking about here. There's a very special example of this. It's covered in 2 Kings 18 and 19, and I'm not going to turn there because we don't have time to read through all of that. But for a few of you, you may have heard, if you listened to Dr. Levy or you've listened to some of his FI online classes, what's called the Sennacherib crisis. Sennacherib was an Assyrian general, and he led the rulers, he led his army down into Israel, took all the Israelites captive, carried them away. Israel ceased to exist as a nation, and then continued southward into the land of Judah. Judah was a pipsqueak nation. I mean, what else can you call it? It was tiny. It had very little power. And the idea of being able to move in there and take that as well was just kind of routine. Sennacherib was actually on his way to Egypt and intended to go even further. The last couple of times we were there, we had the opportunity to visit Lachish. And in Lachish, there is something unique. Approaching the remains of the old city is a ramp. It is the only example in anywhere in the world of an Assyrian siege ramp. Still remains there to this day, where the Assyrians laid siege to Lachish. Now, the Assyrians had quite a reputation. They were among the most violent and cruel of all of the nations in the Middle East when they conquered a people. So if you could project yourself back into this situation, Israel, the northern tribes, had already been carried away into captivity. The strongest city of Judah was Jerusalem, so Sennacherib placed troops around it, laid siege to it in the sense of keeping anybody from being able to enter or leave, and then took the rest of his troops on down to conquer some of the other fortified cities and save Jerusalem for the last. One of those fortified cities was Lachish. The people who are in Jerusalem are surrounded. There's nowhere they can go. There's no way to flee from the Assyrians. It's just simply a matter of waiting. Every day they get up and look over the wall and there are the Assyrians out there waiting. And they know what remains. There's still this kind of fleeting hope that perhaps we can somehow survive, that maybe the siege won't be successful. And when you stand in Lachish, the remains of it today, You look off in the distance to the east, just a little bit to the north of due east, and there's a little rise you can see on the horizon. That's Jerusalem. You can't see anything of the city, but you can see there's something there. And likewise, if you were on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, you would be able to look back in the direction and see a little rise where Lachish was. Not the city, but on a dark night, as all nights were dark back then, there was a fire burning in Lachish. It was a signal fire. It basically said, we're still here. They haven't defeated us yet. So every night as the people of Jerusalem looked in that direction, they looked for that fire. And eventually, it was gone. What does that do to you? What does that do to you when you are there realizing this is the last bastion, this is the last defensive place, and you're next? That's where they were. Now, the story is actually a very inspiring story because you read that Sennacherib foolishly disrespected the God of Israel, sent a letter saying, don't believe your God's going to save you. None of the other gods have. Yours won't either. And you read this wonderful story of King Hezekiah taking the letter, going into the temple, spreading it out, and basically saying, God, look at this. Look what this guy is saying. And as the story progresses, Sennacherib brings the rest of his army, surrounds Jerusalem, and then in one night, 185,000 Assyrian soldiers went to sleep and didn't wake up the next morning. We don't know exactly what happened. I'm sure if you were living in Jerusalem, you didn't care. It just happened. That's good enough. And Sennacherib then, in disgrace, goes back to his home in Nineveh. And in a short period of time, he's in his temple, in the temple of his God, worshiping, and his sons come in and assassinate him. A very powerful story, an inspiring story. But I cannot help but think about what it must have been like to stand on the walls of Jerusalem and see the fire gone. What did it feel like? That kind of stress can really have a powerful impact upon people. In Proverbs 12 and verse 25, Solomon wrote, anxiety in the heart of man causes depression. It's taken centuries for psychologists to figure that out, but yeah, it's true. That's exactly what happens. It produces depression and a whole host of other things. But then Solomon wrote, but a good word makes it glad. And in the midst of difficult times, God does give us good words. You could go back to Matthew 6, verse 25 through 34 in the Sermon on the Mount. We all know verse 33, seek first the kingdom of God. Verse 34 says, therefore, don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Deal with today with the tools you have today. And let God deal with tomorrow. In Philippians 4 and verse 6, Paul says this, Philippians 4, verse 6, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Those are good words. Those are words that help. In a difficult time like this, with unrelenting stress, not getting anxious can be a lot more difficult than it sounds. But it's doable. It's doable. It leads me to lesson number two that I've been learning. Discerning the truth can be a lot more difficult than it sounds. Have you ever known a time when figuring out what's true and what's false has been such a challenge? We have more information available to us than any people have ever had. And it's become harder to figure out what's true and what isn't. Even the experts recommended different strategies at different times. And the result is that many people just get confused and either embrace some senseless slogan or poorly thought out approach, or they just give up. Deciding that if the experts can't agree, then how do we hope to figure it out? Now, those of you that have been around a while may remember a very, very fine gentleman. He's long dead now, but a very fine gentleman from South Texas named Lamar Smith. I don't know if any of you remember Lamar or not. His brother was Carlton, and they're a very fine group of fellows from down there. Several years back, when I was pastoring in Houston, and Mr. Giese was there in Houston, Lamar invited Mr. Giese and I and another elder to come over and spend a couple days deer hunting on a deer lease that he had had for several years between San Antonio and Corpus Christi. When we got there, he was telling us about an incident that he and his grandson had been through just a few weeks earlier. They'd been out working on a deer stand, and they were walking back to the cabin, and he heard a cicada. And his grandson said, "Granddad, what's that?" And he told him, "Well, it was a cicada." And he said, "Well, what's a cicada? Never seen one." So Lamar wanted his grandson to see it, so he began looking around the trees there, trying to figure out where the cicada was, and he's looking and looking and looking, and well, he didn't want to disappoint his grandson, but he just couldn't seem to find it. So he turned around to his grandson, and he said, "Well, I'm sorry, but," he said, I just can't see it." And at that point, he looked a few feet beyond his grandson, and there was a six-foot timber rattler coiled up, rattling. And he realized that that wasn't the cicada he was hearing. That was something very different. Now, I don't know, but I would assume his grandson probably still has that rattle because the snake didn't have any use for it after Lamar finished. But why do I tell you the story? I think it makes a really important point. Sometimes we can be so sure we know something that we end up overlooking something that's really far more important. The truths that are most important to you and me, the truths by which Jesus Christ is now judging us, are not going to be found on Fox News or CNN or on Facebook. Those are not the truths that are most important. The British writer Samuel Johnson was once challenged by a critic for changing his position on an issue over a period of time. And his response was classic. He said, "When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?" And I think that's a good question. Albert Einstein is quoted as saying, "Education is not the learning of facts, but the training of the mind to think." This entire experience, I hope, would show all of us that man's educational systems totally fail to teach people how to think in a reasoned, reliable way. Truth for many people isn't based on some solid, rational standard, but just on how they feel about a subject. You know, one of the characteristics that I think we as human beings share is we all suffer from a problem called confirmation bias. If you're familiar with confirmation bias, basically what it means is that when I read something or see something or hear something that confirms what I already think, I give great weight to that. And if what I hear is contrary to what I believe and think, then I tend to give minimal weight to that. We all as human beings have a tendency to do that. Christians are being trained to become a part of a family and a government of God, restoring truth, real absolute truth to the earth. And we can't allow ourselves to be swept along in the ways of the world around us. Now, in this sermon, I don't intend to tell you what specific sources to trust. I'm struggling with that one myself. But it is scripturally sound to make this point. We all must be careful about being too sure of something we really don't know that much about. In Proverbs 18 and verse 13, Solomon wrote, "He who answers a matter before he hears it, it's folly and shame to him." To answer a matter before we really have gotten the whole picture is folly to that individual. A few verses further down in verse 17, it says, "The first one to plead his cause seems right, but his neighbor comes and examines him." His neighbor comes and says, "Well, wait a minute, what about this? And how does this fit?" And that's a proper thing to do. A few pages further back in Proverbs 15 and verse 21, it says, "Folly is joy to him who's destitute of discernment, but a man of understanding walks uprightly." The Good News Translation puts that verse this way: "Stupid people are happy with their foolishness, but the wise will do what's right." Anybody who doesn't do it doesn't really understand it. Author Ron Carpenter wrote, "A teachable spirit and a humbleness to admit your ignorance or your mistake will save you a lot of pain. However, if you're a person who knows it all, then you've got a lot of heavy-hearted experiences coming your way." In Proverbs 2 and verse 1, again, Solomon says this very well. Proverbs 2, beginning in verse 1, he says, "My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding, yes, if you cry out for discernment," something we have to do, we have to ask for this, "and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then," in verse 5, "you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God." That's really the truth we need. Paul, again, in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 9, says, "And this I pray, that your love may abound still more and more in knowledge and in all discernment." Paul prayed for the brethren in Philippi, and Paul was very close to the brethren in Philippi. That was a church, when you read through the book of Philippians, there's really very little in the way of correction there. Paul was very, very close to this group of people. They were very supportive. He said, "I pray all the time for you that you can have more knowledge and discernment." Verse 10, "that you may approve the things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ." Yes, discerning what's true and what isn't would be a lot harder than what it sounds like. My third point is, loving your neighbor can be more difficult than it sounds. Loving your neighbor can be more difficult than it sounds. Oh, we all know the prophecy from Matthew 24 that Jesus Christ gave himself. Matthew 24, verses 11 and 12. "Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." That's a sobering prophecy coming from the mouth of Jesus Christ himself. That statement is clearly about an attitude that's going to be common in the world as a whole. But that doesn't mean that it's just the world. We can't stand back and say, "Oh, well, he's just talking about those people out there." Doesn't include those of us in the church. Well, actually, there are a couple of reasons why we should conclude that it does. First of all, in verse 4, it begins by saying, "Take heed that no one deceives you." And while it's certainly true that love in the world is going to grow cold, and has, it really doesn't do a whole lot of good to warn the world about that, because they don't listen to him anyway. We're the ones who listen, hopefully. So it's something that we need to take very seriously ourselves. Have you ever found yourself picking up the way the world thinks without even recognizing it? Perhaps like placing too much emphasis on being comfortable. I know people who found that to be true. The Greek words that are used, or the Greek word actually that's translated here, grow cold, is actually only used this one place in Scripture, nowhere else. It describes a gradual, almost imperceptible change that takes place so slowly that the person doesn't even realize it's happening. If you and I think of love as a feeling, we may get the impression that what this is telling us is that there is this warm, fuzzy feeling that we're supposed to have, and it's going to gradually cool down. But as Christians, we've been taught that love, in the biblical sense, isn't primarily a feeling. It's a way of living. A way of living that focuses on the way we treat others. Love is an action verb. You can't command people how to feel, but God commands us to love. So obviously he's not commanding us how to feel. He's commanding us how to live. Love, the action, may lead to love, the feeling. But we can't confuse those two. So how would this kind of godly love, growing cold, manifest itself? What would it look like? How would you recognize it? Now, I'm sure it's not the only time it's ever been said, but as I was preparing this, I was thinking about a story that I heard years ago that came from our summer camp program up in Orr. In that particular case, one of the ministers was giving a Christian living class, and he was talking about love. And he asked all the young people there, he said, okay, what's the opposite of love? And of course, many of them immediately raised, oh, hate is the opposite of love. But there was one young lady who raised her hand and said, no, hate isn't the opposite of love. Love, she said, means caring. The opposite of love is apathy. If love means caring, the opposite of love is just not caring. So when we talk about love growing cold, it doesn't matter of people hating each other. It's a matter of ceasing to care about each other. Isn't that a pretty good description of what we see in the world around us? People have grown tired of the restrictions, the difficulties, tired of being uncomfortable. They just cease to care about anybody but themselves. Now, some people, I think, we would have to recognize are easy to care about. Certainly, we hope that all of us are easy to care about. We'll talk about that in a minute. But there are other people out there that I think make it easy to care about them as well. My wife and I are very pleased. We have some wonderful neighbors. And on the one side is a widow lady and trying to help her through this difficult time. And on the other side, there is an Asian American family. They're, I believe, Chinese in their background, but I just know Asian. And grew up in this country. It wasn't an issue there. They, you know, just like the rest of us. But I don't think we've ever had any better neighbors. They're just very, very kind, very thoughtful, eager to help out in any way they possibly can. Before all of this developed, a couple of months back, we were out in the yard and talking, and we talked to them quite often. He comes over and helps us out with things and so on. They have a couple of young children, and a little boy is probably about, I don't know, I'm going to guess maybe 5 years old. Little girl's probably about three. Little boy's very quiet. The little girl is one of those chatterers. And she is just as sweet as can be. I mean, as soon as you see her, it's a big smile. She wants a hug. She's just as delightful as can be. And we were there talking to them, and the children came out. And they, of course, immediately came to us and began talking to us. And they referred to us as grandfather and grandmother. And my wife and I went back home, and we said, isn't that delightful? I mean, he's taught his children to refer to us in a very respectful and yet a very friendly way. And we were just very touched by it. Those neighbors are really easy to like. You know, it's easy to care about people like that. Some people conduct themselves in ways that make caring about them a little more difficult. And for many people, to be honest, they're just simply easy to ignore. They're easy to not think about one way or another. Caring about a person we don't even know can be challenging. But it is, after all, what God requires of his children. Because God cares about those people, so he expects us to care about them too. And godly love means more than tolerating their presence and their wacky ideas. We know they're wacky because they don't agree with us. Sometimes I have to stop and ask myself, am I making it easier or more difficult for my brethren in the family of God to fulfill God's command to love me? If my words or my actions or my attitudes are making it more difficult, does God care about that? If I'm making obedience to God more difficult for other people, is God just going to shrug his shoulders and overlook my selfish independence? In 1 John 4 and verse 7, John wrote, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." That's a fascinating expression. It really is. God is love. I know that I've heard people use that in a very syrupy way. God is love. No, that's not what we're talking about here. What it says is God defines what godly love is. He's the one who defines that. No one else does. Mother Teresa doesn't define love. Now, I'm not picking on Mother Teresa. I think when she has an opportunity to know God's truth, she's going to be a wonderful Christian. But I use that example because I think back 25 years ago when I heard leaders say, how can you say Mother Teresa is not a Christian? Well, she's teaching people lies. That's one way. But, oh, she's such a nice person. She does all of these wonderful things. Yes, she does. I don't deny that. I don't put her down. But Mother Teresa doesn't define love. God does. Now, therefore, that also tells me political parties and political leaders don't define love. Demonstrators don't define love. And the really tough one to swallow is Dave Johnson doesn't define love either. And neither do you. God does. His is the only definition that matters. And what is that definition? Well, you come up in the next chapter to chapter 5 of 1 John in verse 3. It says, "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome." There's an attitude and an action involved. Those commandments tell us to love God and to love our neighbor. Jesus made it clear that neighbor is a really, really big word. Godly love doesn't stop at the church door. So how are we doing? Have you ever noticed in your life that God never seems to test you on those areas where you thought you might be tested? I know when I was very young, I thought, okay, here are the weaknesses in my life. Here are the areas where God is going to test me as I go forward. Never once did I have a test in those areas. God is so sneaky, he tested me in the areas where I thought I was doing pretty good. And I had to learn some lessons there. Oh, I know, I think back on those days, those early days when we would hear those things about, yeah, there's coming a time when there is this beast power and Christians are going to be martyred. They're going to have to stand up for the truth. And that's going to be, boy, that's when the time comes, boy, I'm going to be ready and I'm going to stand for the truth. But you know what? I think what I'm learning is that maybe the biggest test that we face is not whether we're going to be able to stand up to the beast, but to be whether we're able to love our neighbor now in the way that God says, whether it's easy or difficult, in a time when love is growing cold. That may be the biggest test any of us ever face of the conversion that we have. Loving your neighbor will be a lot more difficult than it seems. Now, my purpose today has simply been to share a few lessons that I've been learning in the hopes that can stimulate others to consider what lessons this unique experience has brought to each of us. God wasn't surprised by what's happened. He's not going to be surprised by what lies ahead. With my age and health condition, I know that I have a giant bullseye painted on me by this virus. And that's been pretty sobering. But I've also taken comfort in the knowledge that God is always in control. I have to do my part, but I also know that God is a healer. And I know at the same time that He has allowed thousands of my brothers and sisters to go to the grave and await the resurrection. So I don't know what He has in store for me. But I take comfort in the fact of knowing that no matter what happens, none of us will live 1 hour more nor 1 hour less than what God determines is best for us. So I hope we will all take advantage of the opportunity to identify, take away the dross, to learn important spiritual lessons at an unprecedented time, and to emerge at the other end, and there will be an end, a lot more prepared for the eternal calling that God has given to each of us.